Goedenavond. Goedenavond. Ik heet u hartelijk welkom. Ik kan u feitelijk elk apart een hand komen geven. Laten we het erop houden dat het een zeer select publiek is. En dat zijn de enige woorden die ik nu in Nederlands heb gesproken, want I'll switch to English now, out of respect for our lecturers. Welcome to this beautiful library. Many thanks to the director, Anne Renard, for having us, for being the host, and also to her collaborator, Leni Albertijn, for organizing this. For the few among you that are not acquainted with NICE, a few words about it. It's an international platform on of academics on the one hand and heritage and research institutes on the other hand. Its purpose is to arrive at a comparative historiography of national movements in Europe. Now, center point of NICE is a database to collect all information about those national movements and to structure them in order to really be able to compare and to see what's common among national movements, regional movements, and what's peculiar among those movements. Now, around this database and the data we put in them, we organize a lot of events. We publish a number of series and also a online journal. We also are in the process of building a database on bibliographical information around nationalism. It's called State of Nationalism. You'll find all that information on our website, www.nice.eu. So among those events we organize is, of course, the NICE lectures. Now, NICE lectures are the odd one out among our activities, and why? Because, first of all, it's for a larger public, in principle. It's not, normally it's a NICE platform or works with NICE members, by NICE members, for NICE members. So the NICE lectures are the odd one out because it's destined for a larger public in theory. Secondly, it's by principle held in Flanders. And why? Because NICE is most part funded by the Flemish government, and we have the principle to have one event each year in Flanders. So that's the NICE lectures. Now, this is the fourth. The first one was by John Broy about global history, his search for a global history of nationalism. The second was from Peter Aronson about the results of his European projects on identity formation by national museums in the 19th and 20th century. The third one last year was by Ostap Sereda from the University of Lvov about the identity formation on the margins of imperia. In this case, the Austro-Hungarian Imperium. So, what is the purpose? What is the core subject of NICE lectures? It's presenting new inroads into nationalism, into theory formation of nationalism, to present new theories about nationalism and theory formation on nationalism. And so we are very glad today for the fourth NICE lecture to welcome Carrie Hamilton, Dr. Carrie Hamilton from the University of Roehampton in London. She's reading history at the university, and she will be presenting her lecture on the subject of feminism and nationalism. So, Carrie, if I may say, Carrie, take it away.
Good. Thank you. Thank you very much. Can everyone can hear me okay? Good. Well, first of all, I want to thank you very much, Luke, and to the other members of NEES and to the organizers for inviting me, and for all of you for coming. It is a select audience, so we'll stay with that. I am going to read, but I'll try not to be too formal. It's my first time here in Antwerp as well, so it's really an honor to be here on such an occasion and to give the lecture, and also to, I had a tour of the NEES archive previously, and also to be in this absolutely stunning building, so this is really delightful. The other reason I welcome this invitation is, for me, it's been an opportunity to, I would say, situate myself or resituate myself in my own present time and place, partly because the question in the air for all of us who are resident in the United Kingdom right now is an open one about what it means to be European citizens in a nation state that is in the early stages of exiting, or believes it is exiting, the European Union. Now, if the events of the past 6 months in Britain and the United States tell us anything, it is that states, nation states, national identity, and nationalisms of various different kinds are very much alive. And although they have undergone many, many developments and changes over the last 200 years, and that's one of the, you know, the purposes of NEES is to kind of, you know, explore and to compare those changes across a whole range of nationalisms, I think that declarations of the end of nationalisms or the end of nation states in the wake of globalization, transnational movements, have been premature and even, I would say now, naive. We've for some time been living in an age of globalization and transnational flows of all kinds, but we most certainly are not living in an era of post-nationalism. Or I should say, if it is a post-nationalist era, it's one in which nationalisms themselves share with post-nationalism. So the strange shared of transnationalism or post-nationalisms, I think we can safely consider. And it's this relationship of nationalism to post-nationalism is one of the things that I want to consider over the course of this talk. Now, I approach the question of nationalism and national identities as a historian, and specifically a historian of Europe in the contemporary period, and with a particular interest in the history of women and gender and of feminism. With these things in mind, I want to begin this talk with a bit of time travel by revisiting some of my historical research on women and radical Basque nationalism in the late 20th century in the context of recent events in the Basque country, in Europe, and internationally. Along the way, I want to consider as well some of the ways feminism and nationalism inform one another, and in what ways feminism may help to understand national identities and other forms of identities that intersect with it. Just over 20 years ago, in the mid-1990s, I embarked on a research project on women's participation in radical Basque nationalism. That part of the Basque nationalist project that was and is committed to independence, and was at that time and for many decades also committed to achieving independence through armed struggle. For those of you who are perhaps not so familiar with the history of this particular corner of Europe, the radical Basque nationalist organization ETA, which means in the Basque language, Basque homeland and freedom, was founded in 1959 during the Franco dictatorship. From the late 1960s until its declaration of a definitive ceasefire 5 years ago in 2011, ETA waged a campaign of political violence, what most call, I think accurately, terrorism, against members of the army, politicians, and civilians in the Basque country and throughout Spain, thereby creating one of Europe's most enduring conflicts between a non-state nationalism and a nation state in recent history. I was led to the topic of women in ETA largely by an interest in the question of which factors, personal and political, and individual as well as collective, had led some women to become involved in an armed organization under the specific historical conditions of late Francoist Spain and the transition to democracy in the 1970s. But my choice of topic was also influenced by the more immediate historical context in which I myself trained as a feminist historian in the early 1990s. These were the years immediately following the collapse of state socialism in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, and the catastrophic wars in the former Yugoslavia, with a particularly devastating impact on women, as sexual violence was used as a strategy in campaigns of so-called ethnic cleansing. In these years, it seemed crystal clear with which side of nationalism feminists should, indeed must, stand, morally as well as politically. In a series of articles, books, and journal, special journal issues published in Europe and North America in the early to mid-1990s, feminist historians and other scholars wrote passionately about the dangers of nationalism for women. There was certainly an awareness that in other parts of the world, most notably much of the global south, nationalism had different meanings and possibilities for women and men, linked to the anti-colonial independence movements of the post-World War II period. But where Europe was concerned, there was by and large feminist consensus in the late 20th century. Nationalism was bad news for women, as well as for ethnic and religious minorities. The Basque Country, however, like Northern Ireland, did not fit so neatly into the North-South divide taken for granted in much of the European feminist literature on nationalism. Founded under a military dictatorship during the 1950s, ETA, similarly to the IRA, had been directly inspired by the national liberation movements in Latin America, Asia, and Africa. Even if ETA's claim that the Basque Country was the Cuba of Europe flew in the face of some basic economic and geopolitical realities, the radical nationalist struggle against first the Franco regime and later a liberal democratic Spanish state made radical nationalism differ in substantial ways from those resurgent European nationalisms backed up by powerful state armies. Two decades later, wariness in the face of European nationalisms remains well entrenched in the feminist literature, even if this literature has taken on a different set of concerns. Nationalism appears less often today in the titles of feminist books and journal articles. Instead, we read more often terms like transnationalism and postnationalism, as I've already alluded. Before the 1990s, and especially since 2001, the literature on nationalism in Europe has been increasingly concerned with questions of citizenship and especially with transnational migration, both into Europe and inside Europe. The focus of feminist concern and critique has been with ways in which insurgent nationalisms within established states have constructed the immigrant as the single greatest threat to the national sovereignty of individual states and indeed to the European Union and to Europe as a whole. Examples of this renewal of ethnocentric and often racist nationalism are too many to name, but I will highlight the rhetoric of the Leave campaign during the UK referendum on the European Union just 6 months ago, which successfully mobilized these anti-immigration feelings. I single out the anti-EU campaign for mention because it's in this Brexit moment that my most recent reconsiderations on the relationship between feminism and nationalism in Europe have taken place. And it's from this time and place that I now want to travel back to the Basque Country. When I was studying the small group of women who during the 1960s and 70s took the path of armed activism by joining ETA, I also formed a number of broader conclusions about the ways in which radical Basque nationalism was gendered. That is, I identified patterns of how understandings of masculinity and femininity, views about women's and men's proper roles within the family, within society, and within politics were connected to wider questions of national identity, and how these ideas in turn shaped the roles and experiences of women and men within the Basque nationalist movement, the radical nationalist movement, and indeed the development of the dynamics of what would become the Basque conflict, by which I mean this ongoing struggle between ETA and the forces of the Spanish state. Although the historical forms of what I call the gender politics of radical Basque nationalism were specific to their time and place, comparative studies indicate that the roles of women and men in the movement were in many ways similar to other nationalist movements in the West in the contemporary era. And these are the four main conclusions that I drew from that study. First of all, historically, Basque nationalists from the late 19th century onwards had defined women's roles in terms of their capacity as mothers. Studies of nationalisms elsewhere in the 20th century confirm that for nationalist movements, womanhood is largely synonymous with motherhood. Even women who did not have children themselves were discursively constructed as surrogate mothers. Their jobs were to raise and educate future generations, most notably by passing on national cultural and heritage, and language particularly. What Neera Yuvaldevas has called women as the producers or reproducers of the nation. In the case of radical Basque nationalism, this reproductive role was extended as well to the care of sons, the young men and predominantly young men in Eta. Thus, the most visible role for women in the radical Basque nationalist communities from the 1960s onwards was the mourning mothers of dead or imprisoned male Eta members. My second argument was that beyond the literal reproduction of new generations of Basques and and Eta activists, women were tasked with the reproduction of Basque language and culture. And because this historical association of women with language and culture, most of the women who joined Eta in the 1960s and 70s did so via their activities in cultural movements. And this was unlike men, who were more likely to join through seminaries, workplaces, or social groups, spaces which were largely off limits for women during the Franco period. Third, the symbolic equation woman-mother remained well entrenched through the late 20th century and even into the early 20th century. And even as more and more women became involved in radical nationalism, including as armed activists. In other words, the symbolic power of the woman-mother equation was such that it persisted even with gender roles inside ETA and in wider society were changing quite dramatically. Fourth and finally, parallel to these developments in ETA, following the death of Franco in 1975, the Basque country developed one of the strongest feminist movements in Spain. But feminism and nationalism had a complicated and often conflictual relationship. The independent women's movement, though not necessarily anti-nationalist, maintained a distance from ETA and radical nationalism. Nationalism, and especially the use of political violence, were seen as largely divisive among feminists. At the same time, feminist groups founded within ETA's orbit struggled to have women's issues taken seriously and prioritized by fellow nationalists. Nationalist feminists were often accused of comrades of being petty bourgeois, and there was an implicit hierarchy of identities and priorities, with what was perceived as the national conflict taking priority over other causes, including feminism. Throughout the late 20th and into the early 21st century, ETA terrorism and the Basque conflict came to define Basque politics to the point that other political and social movements, including feminism, were largely muted in the Spanish, Basque, and international media. Basque politics became synonymous for many with national conflict and terrorism. By the time ETA announced its permanent ceasefire 5 years ago, the Basque panorama was dramatically different from what it had been in the 1960s and even from the 1990s when I'd conducted my research. Traditional family structures based on heterosexual couples, children, and extended family networks, which had been upheld by nationalists as the basis for the Basque community throughout most of the 20th century, were increasingly supplemented by new kinship formations, including single and childless women and men, same-sex couples, and queer families. Equally importantly, migration from outside Spain increasingly complicated the oft-taken-for-granted division of Basque society into Basques and Spaniards. Some of the most interesting historical research being done in the Basque country today expands its attention beyond the confines of the national conflict, focusing on the other vibrant political and social movements and communities that have emerged since the end of the dictatorship, including feminism, environmentalism, international solidarity, and music, film, and other artistic initiatives. This innovative research also expands the meaning of difference That is, it insists that the conflicts based on class on the one hand and Basque and Spanish nationhood on the other always take place in relation to other social power relations. In this regard, the ETA ceasefire of 2011 has facilitated, I think, an intellectual as well as political opening, creating new spaces in which to reconsider the historical meanings of the Basque conflict, as well as the possibilities for imagining a post-conflict society. And I want now to turn to one of these initiatives in order to reflect some more on how the present situation sheds light on the historical relationship between feminism and nationalism. In late September of this year, I attended in the Basque city of Bilbao the presentation of a document entitled Emagune, some conclusions on shared reflections relating to peace and coexistence. Emagune is a Basque neologism, playing on the word emakune, the Basque word for woman. It means roughly woman's place and refers to a group that emerged in the spring of 2014, one of a number of initiatives throughout the Basque country that arose following ETA's permanent ceasefire, aimed at exploring the social and potential possibilities of a post-conflict society. Now, this was not the first time a group of women from different political communities had come together in the Basque country to discuss possible peace. The document presented in September officially, or specifically mentions AUTSAC, which is a group, a name meaning voices, a short-lived initiative following a previous ETA ceasefire announced in 2006, in which women from across some, though not all, of the political spectrum came together to promote a peaceful transition after the ceasefire. In a political landscape divided by competing nationalisms and the fallout of both state and non-state violence, attempts to bridge political divides had for decades been notoriously difficult in the Basque Country, and it still is in many ways. The Emagune document does not make any concrete political proposals and has no official status. I'm not even sure whether it's had much kind of notice in more formal political circles. But I think it's notable, and I want to talk about it today, because it intervenes on a number of points that reflect the complexity of the lived realities of women and men in the Basque Country, and takes as a starting point the insistence that the Basque conflict be understood beyond the confines in which it is usually defined, that is, as more than a national conflict between Basques and Spaniards, and even between ETA and the Spanish state. The Emagune document does not present itself as a feminist intervention. In fact, the authors explicitly say that not all women in their group consider themselves feminist. But they do validate feminism as, and I quote, a fundamental resource and an instrument of analysis for social transformation. While thus pointing towards a collective future, the members of Emagune draw implicitly on feminist histories. Like some Basque feminists before them, for example, those in the late 1970s who called for the amnesty of women charged with abortion offenses, or who defined as political violence the rape and murder of young women by far-right paramilitary squads who operated during the transition to democracy, the Emagune activists call for an expanded understanding of conflict beyond the historical conflict, that is, the armed conflict between ETA and the Spanish state. The document reminds us of the multitudes of other forms of violence that affect people living in the Basque Country, including gender violence, and those arising from other forms of inequality, class, race, religion. Gender and other inequalities understood as barriers to peace. In this sense, the Emagune document echoes other women's peace initiatives, for example, those studied by Cynthia Coburn in the Balkans, Cyprus, and Northern Ireland. It also offers an important alternative, I think, to the question that guides most historical and other studies of ETA. Why was there an armed conflict in the Basque Country and not in other parts of Spain? What are the causes of nationalist violence? If we stop understanding radical nationalist violence as the only form of violence worth talking about in the Basque Country, Or if we cease to see it as so exceptional, other questions can be asked. And yet studies of ETA continue overwhelmingly to study the Basque conflict as if it existed in isolation from other forms of violence and conflict that beset modern societies. Violence against women, violence against migrants and people without papers, and most recently the violence of financial and social exclusion that gave rise to the 15th of March movement throughout Spain in 2011 in the wake of the severe economic crisis. There are other ways in which the Imagune document reflects what I would call a feminist reading of reality. While avowedly embracing the category women, it recognizes differences among women on a number of levels: political orientation, sexuality, religious belief, ethnicity, and class. Furthermore, the document does not assume that women's main relationship to society and politics, to conflict and peace, is through reproduction, cultural or otherwise. In fact, interestingly, there's no mention at all of women's status as mothers in the document. Now, during the late Franco dictatorship, when the use of the Basque language, euskera, in public was criminalized, family homes were one of the few places where language could flourish. In these circumstances, mothers were afforded special responsibility for the teaching of Basque to their children, an example of the cultural reproduction of the nation noted by Yuval Davis and others. Women also taught in the earliest Basque language schools, ikastolas. The Ikastola movement had its roots in the initiatives of the women's section of the Basque Nationalist Party during the 1920s and 1930s, and in the clandestine euskera classes given in nationalist homes and churches under Franco. After the return to democracy and the establishment of a Basque autonomy statute in 1978, the teaching of Basque language, both to children and adults, was institutionalized, whether by the state or through private organizations. Though speaking Basque at home is still widely encouraged by Basque nationalists today, the family home is no longer considered the main site of language reproduction, especially given that the majority of the Basque population still speaks Spanish at home. The importance of language to women's sense of identity is stated directly in the Imagune paper. But significantly, women are not burdened with the responsibility of the survival of the language. The document recognizes that Spanish and euskera share territory with other languages in the Basque Country, and that many women do not speak these two official languages. At the same time, the authors stress that the two official languages do not exist in parity, and note explicitly that the difficulties for different reasons and at different historical moments in learning and using euskera has generated in us, that is the writers, feelings of frustration, orphanhood, injustice, and displacement. I'm struck here not only by the sense of loss generated by the lack of equal access to euskera, but also the use of the concept of orphanhood. The use of this term shifts the emphasis from women as teachers to learners of language, and therefore disrupts any straightforward understanding of nations' relationship to generation, and specifically of women's roles in reproducing the nation. This is not, moreover, a celebration of orphanhood as a form of freedom. And here it's important to recognize the historical differences with those European subjects of the late 20th centuries who chose, in the words of the Italian oral historian Luisa Passerini, to be orphans as an expression of the new political subjectivities they formed during the 1960s and 1970s. In her research on the Italian generation of 68, Passerini writes that for some of the Italians born in the post-fascist, post-World War II period, the emergence of new social and political subjectivities demanded, quote, a doubled emancipation from society and from the family. This process of liberation, she argues, was different for young women and men, precisely because of the divergent roles of mothers and fathers in most family households. In the stories of Italy's 68ers, fathers play an ambivalent role. They are, according to Passerini, quote, affectionate and absent, authoritarian and weak. And yet these fathers furnished the imagination with some sparks of possible rebellion, end quote. But if fathers were necessary for a sense of political inheritance, for many young Italian activists, young female activists generally opted for a rejection of their mothers, and especially of the kind of post-war femininity these women often represented for them. This distancing from the maternal figure was, according to Passerini, a common part of the process of becoming new female political subjects in Italy on the left in the 1960s and 70s. There are both parallels and contrasts with the case of young ETA activists during the same years. In my work on the gender politics of radical Basque nationalism, I've criticized the extent to which nationalist narratives, indeed, as well as anti-nationalist versions of history, focus on the relationship between fathers and sons. In these histories, ETA is understood to have arisen in the 1950s among young men who were not only marginalized by the Spanish national Catholicism of the Francoist state, but were also angry at the older generation for losing the Spanish Civil War and at what they perceived as their father's failure to stand up to the dictatorship. To the extent that women feature in this version of the past at all, they are in the background, typically as one-dimensional characters, mothers, and associated with the home. There are no daughters in this story. The tale of nationalist generations gets complicated when gender gets taken into account. Daughters, I argued, could not afford to reject their fathers as political failures because they needed these men as political role models in a world in which women had almost no role in the public political sphere. At the same time, they did not reject their mothers, although their relationship to motherhood was often ambiguous. Many early female ETA activists would not go on to become mothers themselves. Moreover, in addition to their fathers, they often spoke of single childless women as important role models when they were growing up and becoming politically aware. In my research on women active in early radical Basque nationalism, I stress that these single childless women, who were often referred to by the women I interviewed as independent women, provided examples of womanhood that defied the ideals of wife and motherhood promoted both by Basque nationalism and, equally importantly, by Francoist national Catholicism in the 1950s and 60s. In the interviews I conducted with early members of ETA, there was usually a silence around the sexual identities or lives of these independent women, a silence I think that speaks to a persisting taboo around non-normative forms of female sexuality, that is, sexuality that is not defined by a relationship to a particular man. Historically, Basque nationalism, like other traditional nationalisms, including Francoism, had dealt with the anomaly of women who were not mothers or not wives, alternatively by making them into surrogate mothers for the nation or through the convent. Such women were implicitly constructed as asexual in societies in which the only sanctioned form of female sexuality was heterosexual and married. As the editors of the volume Nationalism Sexualities noted some 25 years ago, quote, the idealization of motherhood by the virile fraternity of nationalism would seem to entail the exclusion of all non-reproductively oriented sexualities from the discourse of the nation. Indeed, certain sexual identities and practices are less represented and representable in nationalism. And I think that's something that's changing in Basque nationalism in the contemporary period. Now, sticking with this theme of political inheritances and role models, we might note that histories of nationalist and feminist movements have often been written as stories of generations. The history of European and North American feminism has often been told in a series of waves, in which certain generations are marked out as collective historical actors. So there's the first wave in Europe of early 20th century suffragists, the second wave of the 1960s and 70s, often associated with women's liberation, And finally, a third wave, often associated with kind of new technologies and so on, around the time of the millennium. These modes of history telling have some usefulness in identifying changing feminist priorities, as well as continuing concerns. But of course, they simplify the story. They not only exclude those historical actors who do not fit neatly into a particular generation, they also leave gaps in our historical memory of periods when feminist struggle was a slow burn rather than a raging fire. If as historians we must always put historical subjects and actors in their wider context, this is not the same, I think, as assigning them to a specific generation. Generations are useful analytical tools as long as they do not become reductive and explanatory. The Emagune document, I suggest, is a multi-generational document, less a celebration of women of different ages than a recognition that no single generation or age group can speak to and about the Basque conflict with special authority. The paper speaks not only of a sense of orphanhood in relation to language loss, but also of a feeling of displacement. Displacement reminds us, in turn, of the importance of the attachment to place and location in the construction of identities, including national identities. The reference to language in Euskera in particular as an access of conflict echoes earlier interventions as well. Historically, the association of Euskera with motherhood and women generally acted to obscure unequal access to language as a form of social and political expression. As one group of female ETA supporters living in exile in the French Basque Country in the mid-1970s expressed it, women transmit the language but don't have the right to speak. By linking the issue of identity and language discursively to gender, migration, and work, the Emagune authors recognize that the right to speak remains an issue of power in the contemporary Basque Country, one that affects women and men with different histories and access to the public sphere. Feminist literary theory recognizes the relationship between the native tongue and dreams of home in a way that highlights the violence incurred by forcing people to speak the dominant language, but without romanticizing a woman-centered relationship to the mother tongue. As feminist philosopher Rosie Braidotti, drawing on the psychoanalytic of Jacques Lacan, writes, "There is no such thing as a mother tongue. All tongues carry the name of the father and are stamped by its register." Psychoanalysis also teaches us the irreparable loss of a sense of steady origin that accompanies the acquisition of language, any language. End of quote. Braidotti is correct, I believe, to point out the dangers of making exclusionary claims based on a fantasy of an originary mother tongue. "There are no mother tongues," she writes, "just linguistic sites. One takes her or his starting point from." I draw on her work, that is the work of Braidotti, because she's one of the contemporary feminist theorists writing most compellingly about subjectivity, language, sexuality, difference, post-nationalism, and Europeanness. But in urging us to have a healthy skepticism about steady identities and mother tongues, Braidotti does not distinguish adequately, to my mind, among the different forms of, quote, nationalism, regionalism, and localism that reemerged, often in violent forms, in the early late 20th century. I think when she was writing in the 1990s and onward, she had in mind the murderous, racist, and misogynist violence carried out in the former Yugoslavia during the early 1990s. But when speculating that, quote, "Is not every appeal to the right mother tongue the matrix of terror, fascism, or despair," unquote, she appears to forget how easily such terms, terror and fascism especially, are wrenched from their historical context and applied to any number of movements, so that soon all nationalisms risk being equated with fascism. In the Basque context, the repeated association of ETA with Nazism is a case in point. When ETA violence is explained neatly as an inevitable outcome of ethnic nationalism, and ethnicity is associated with language, it's a small step to the conclusion that the demand to be able to learn and speak Euskera is in itself a form of fascism. The Emagune document, while recognizing the political dimension of language, explicitly warns against the use of language for ideological ends, of associating Euskera and its use with one particular political viewpoint. The attachment of Basque of different gender identities to Euskera cannot and should not be explained as some kind of atavistic attachment to a language of origin, as a form of small-minded localism or petty linguistic nationalism. There are obvious power differences between hegemonic languages in the case of Basque country, Spanish, and French, and minority languages such as Basque or Catalan. For this reason, while I share Bridotti's celebration of multilingualism as part of her theory of nomadic subjectivity, I caution against what I detect in her writing on language as a resistance to recognizing these kinds of power relationships among different languages. Such relations cannot be overcome by the celebration in terms of the philosopher Gilles Deleuze, on whose work Bridotti draws repeatedly, of the becoming minor of major languages such as Spanish, French, or English, although this is surely a desirable process. When Bridotti writes of the flair for the sense of heterogeneous dialects and idioms that resist unification, or says that moving between languages, speaking several and mastering none, living in constant simultaneous translation, is a possible location for the nomadic sensibility, end quote, she would do well as well to take into account the politics of education and access to language, which are grounded in historical and material conditions. These conditions continue to shape the language, the politics of language learning in the Basque Country, where Euskera, notwithstanding significant developments over the past 40 years, remains a minority and even endangered language. For this reason, I understand why many of my Basque-speaking friends are not quite prepared to celebrate the nomadic practice of moving between Euskera and Spanish when the latter is the predominant language of the Basque public sphere, even while they encourage the multilingualism of their children as part of a European identity and a European reality. Linguistic displacement is not the only form of dislocation recognized in the Emagune document. Implicitly expanding its understanding of Basque belonging beyond nationalist concepts of family or birthright, the document expresses concern both about the levels of xenophobia against migrants in the Basque Country and what its authors perceive as a generalized lack of self-awareness around ethnocentrism and Eurocentrism. Again, there are echoes here of the past. The document is perhaps intentionally ambiguous on the definition of immigration. Historically, migration to the Basque Country from other parts of Spain, most notably during the late 19th century and again in the 1950s and 1960s, periods of rapid industrialization, have been cited as major factors in the emergence and reemergence of Basque nationalism as a political force. The relationship between ethnic Basques and immigrants from other regions of Spain has historically been a fraught one, with language acquisition sometimes understood by nationalists as a necessary act of integration. Spanish nationalists, in contrast, have always been alert to any sign of Basque identity that excludes migrants, quick to declare that Basque nationalism is by definition racist. The Emagune document evokes these histories of intolerance, but does not fall into the trap of playing Basque identity against Spanish. Calling for respect for multiple identities, this is a rejection of these aspects of historical Basque and Spanish nationalist discourses, which propose to impose homogeneous identities. In this, the paper echoes more recent solidarity movements across Spain, which have resisted the national government in Madrid's anti-immigration policies. The predominant trend in the academic literature on Basque nationalism, in both its mainstream conservative guys, which I associate with the Basque Nationalist Party, and its radical manifestation associated with ETA and the world around ETA, is to claim that it's an ethnic nationalism based on claims of common ancestry, culture, and language. And this, of course, is following Anthony Smith's oft-cited formulation, which would then contrast ethnic Basque nationalism to civic nationalism. Often Catalan nationalism is given as an example of that in the Spanish context. Now, there's certainly evidence that historically, especially in the late 19th century, at the time of the founding of the Basque Nationalist Party and well into the 20th century, Basque nationalism was predominantly of the ethnic variety and even had a strong racially exclusive element. ETA and radical nationalism adopted and adapted this ethnic nationalism in the 1960s and 70s, and traces of a kind of xenophobic definition of Basque-ness based on language and culture, I think, are still sometimes detectable in radical nationalist discourse and action. But the insistence by many scholars that ETA and radical nationalism are ethnically exclusive demonstrates a lack of attention to changing historical context, as well as, I think, to methodological problems and limitations. And I think here that this issue of methodology is especially relevant at NICE, where you've initiated an impressive and important work of gathering archives of different nationalist movements. And considering nationalist movements not just as kind of official political parties, but also questions of how nationalist actors, I think private citizens is one of the languages, terms that NICE uses, relate to nationalism and live their national identity in a day-to-day way. Studies of nationalism in the Basque Country have tended so far to be based on written texts and speeches, which are kind of the official line, as it were, of nationalism, and these are very important. But they appear, these studies, less interested in examining the evidence of the more dynamic ways in which nationalist activities have negotiated, nationalist activists, rather, have negotiated their identities and practice. Oral history, which is one of the methodologies that I've used in my own work, I think is a very valuable source that allows for a more complex understanding of how nationalist women and men have identified over time, how their identities have changed, how their national identities have intersected with other identities, including those of class, gender, for example, and Europeanness. The argument that Basque nationalism remains ethnic and exclusive is moreover complicated by more recent developments in the early 21st century. Since the late 20th century, migration to the Basque Country from outside Spain, primarily from Latin America, North Africa, and Asia and Eastern Europe, has increased steadily, indeed at a rate higher than that to many other areas of Spain. As the political scientist Sanjay Jaram has argued, political reactions to this move have proven the opposite of what might be expected of a so-called ethnic nationalist movement. When the Spanish government in Madrid under the Conservative Party instituted a clear anti-immigration policy in 2000, the ruling Basque Nationalist Party reacted by moving towards policies designated to welcome migrants and incorporate them into their definition of Basque citizenship. Jaram understands this development as part of a wider trend among non-state nationalisms in Europe. Another example is that of the Scottish Nationalist Party, which has consistently positioned itself in opposition to the xenophobic anti-immigrant rhetoric and policy of successive conservative governments in Westminster in recent years, especially again following the affirmative outcome of the Brexit referendum this past June. Here we see minority non-state nationalisms embracing the ideals of solidarity and openness as central to both national and European identities, and against the exclusionary nationalism of the dominant state. It would be unwise, of course, to exaggerate this trend or to ignore the contradiction it throws up in practice. Solidarity with migrants in any context is not determined by national identity alone and also intersects with other factors, including economics and social class and generation, for example. Neither the Basque Country nor Scotland, which are predominantly white and Christian populations, can be held up as havens of anti-racism and inclusion. My point is rather that the conventional academic wisdom that Basque nationalism is in its essence racist and anti-migration is complicated both by the workings of competing nationalisms and, in the case of Europe, differing understandings of and attachments to the idea and the ideal of the European Union. The incorporation of ethnic religious difference into the very definition of Basque identity may to some extent be pragmatic. We can compare it, for example, to the Catalan Parliament's law banning bullfighting in 2010, which, though the outcome of more than two decades of animal welfare activism in Catalonia, was also facilitated by the construction of the bullfight as something quintessentially Spanish. But the recent embrace of mainstream Basque nationalism of migrants also suggests that national identity and nationalism are less rigid, more flexible than often characterized, especially by self-styled anti-nationalists in Spain and elsewhere. This is a reminder that nationalism need not be exclusionary or racist. I'm not suggesting that the Basque Country is free of these problems or that there are not signs of anti-migrant sentiment there, as in the rest of Europe, where anti-migrant sentiment is sometimes justified in terms of protection of minority group and its language. But this form of xenophobia is not exclusive to non-state nationalisms. It also exists in the United Kingdom, where demands that migrants learn English are used to screen them and to regulate their access to citizenship. A language need not be a threatened one, nor a minority one, in order for it to be used as an alibi for racism and exclusion. The official and popular forms of solidarity demonstrated towards migrants in the Basque Country are moreover a reminder that regionalism and nationalism do not exclude an internationalist outlook. The process of constructing contemporary Basque identities through welcoming and exchange with new migrants is part of a longer history in which radical Basque nationalist activists' subjectivities were formed through identification with other communities inside and outside the Basque Country. Here I'm following again Luisa Passerini's inspirational work on identification and historical subjectivity among the generation of 1968 in Italy. Drawing on the psychoanalytically inspired work of the postcolonial critic and theorist of nationalism, Homi Bhabha, Passerini argues, quote, "The use of the idea of identification allows one to highlight the relationship between the individual and various collectivities, and therefore the relationship between and the nature of historical subjects, avoiding or at least reducing the risk of reification implicit in the term identity. Furthermore, it can bring to light the differing degrees of investment placed in identity in different historical periods. Use of the term identification seems pertinent for the historian's work since it emphasizes both the dynamic element and the factor of personal choice," end quote. Let's consider the historical conditions of the early 21st century under which new Basque subjectivities are being constructed, whether nationalist or not. And let's remember here that the Emagune document is not a nationalist document, but one in which Basque national identity is at least implicit. Over the past decade or so, a relatively rapid rise in non-Spanish migration to the Basque Country has occurred during a time of both ongoing economic political crisis in Spain and the rise of aggressively anti-migration rhetoric and policies throughout Europe. Migration to the Basque Country is, as everywhere in Europe, one of the emergencies of the moment. The writers of the Emagune document recognize this, and they have historical precedents among earlier activists who combined a concern for national issues with transnational ones. 40 or 50 years ago, young Basque women who became involved in nationalist or feminist politics participated in a process of identification in a different set of circumstances. The end of the Franco dictatorship, the transition to liberal democracy in Spain, the proliferation of political left parties on the far left, nationalist and nationalist, non-nationalist, with strongly international outlook, the rise of a series of post-1968 social movements, and so on. In these earlier times, many young Basques of different political identities, women as well as men, identified strongly with the working class, both locally and internationally, women as well as men, and whether they came from the working class or the middle class themselves. Some of them took Fidel Castro and Che Guevara as their idols. "We were all totally in love. They were in love with Fidel, with Cuba," recalled one woman I interviewed about the left-wing political group she joined in the 1960s. Another interviewee recalled going to work in factories along Bilbao's Nervión River in order to participate directly in workers' struggles. Whether they allied with ETA or with Trotskyist or Maoist parties, these young activists considered themselves to be internationalist as well as Basque. Rejecting identity as Spanish was for many of them part of a national identity as Basque, as well as a rejection of Spanish nationalism in the post-Franco years. But this move away from the nation state as the main source of identity was hardly unique to young Basques in this period. I'm not drawing a direct continuous line between the young nationalist activists who identified with local workers and international anti-colonialists 40 or 50 years ago, and today's Basque women of different generations, some feminists, some not, some nationalists, some not, who identify with migrants and other collectivities. History is more complicated than that. But again, inspired by Passerini, I detect in the Emagune author's expression of solidarity with migrants an echo of the emotional as well as political commitment to international solidarity widespread among young activists in the 1960s and 70s in the Basque Country and in Spain and the rest and much of the rest of Europe. Today, as in the earlier period, these processes of identification are individual as well as collective, dependent on their different locations and past experiences, as well as their desires and dreams for the future. Over the past two decades, a number of Basque and Spanish intellectuals have proposed post-nationalism as an alternative to what they see as a dangerous nationalist hegemony in the Basque Country, which they understand in turn as the root cause of ETA violence. Nationalism in these formulations is understood as the expression of a restricted form of identity that needs to be overcome in the process of democratization. But following the work of Cameron Watson and Richard Kearney, I suggest that much of this writing on so-called post-nationalism in Spain has simply reproduced a new binary and hierarchy in which post-nationalism is positioned as a supposedly more enlightened, democratic form of belonging against nationalism as a retrograde and violent form. As Kearney wrote some 20 years ago in relation to what he called post-nationalist Ireland, quote, "In endeavoring to go beyond negative nationalism, one must be wary not to succumb to the opposite extreme of anti-nationalism. Those who identify all forms of nationalism with iridescent fanaticism habitually do so in the name of some neutral standpoint that masks their own ideological bias," unquote. In Spain, the post-nationalist position has been vociferously defended by a group of intellectuals who are indeed loath to reflect upon their own ideological bias, which is in the main Spanish, nationalist, and conservative. Watson argues, however, moreover, that post-nationalism does not, as many observers seem to think, imply the end of nationalism, but rather a kind of accommodation, much like that of postmodernity with the modern condition, between nationalism and changing social, economic, political, and cultural realities, unquote. As I've already suggested, the recent adoption of policies to welcome migrants to the Basque Country is one example of these changing social, economic, political, and cultural realities. The Scottish Nationalist Party's affirmation of its commitment to the European Union as a response to the anti-EU policies of Brexit is another example. This is not to idealize nationalism as totally egalitarian and progressive in these contexts, but it's rather to suggest that the call for post-nationalism as more democratic than nationalism may be premature, or at least may be based on a reductive understanding of all nationalisms, state and substate, being similarly exclusionary. It may moreover be based on an unwillingness to interrogate the multiple and many attachments to the nation state that permeate even ostensibly anti-nationalist and post-nationalist critique. For feminists, the idea of accommodating nationalism may feel difficult to say the least because of the histories I've referred to earlier. If feminism appears in the Emagune document as a valuable tool, not necessarily a unifying force, but as something that may help to promote solidarity among women, the word nationalism does not appear in the document at all. We can speculate that this is because historically and still today, nationalism remains fiercely divisive in Basque politics. Yet nationalism is there in the document implicitly, neither condoned nor condemned. That silence itself is worthy of comment. For the Basque Country may be living in a moment of post-conflict, but it's certainly not post-nationalist nation in the sense of moving beyond or out of nationalism. Just 1 week before the Emagune presentation, the Basque Nationalist Party, which has controlled the parliament of the Basque Autonomous Region for almost steadily for four decades since it was founded in 1978, won the regional elections yet again. If the Emagune document can be characterized as post-nationalist, a term like nationalist itself, which is absent from the paper, It's not in the sense of anti-nationalism, but perhaps in a sense of trying to accommodate different forms of nationalism and national identity. It's perhaps post-nationalist, but not post-nationalisms. Moreover, the call to post-nationalism risks underestimating the ongoing significance of nation states in contemporary Europe and throughout the world, and a brushing over the significant privileges that come with membership of nation states, especially those in the global north. The authors of the Emagone document are not stateless. They are very much part of the Spanish, and in some cases, the French state, as well as the EU. That is their geopolitical and juridical location. As Judith Butler would put it, it's the states they are in. To be a citizen of a state that one does not recognize or desire as one's own is not the same as being stateless. To possess a European passport other than the European passport to which one aspires is to retain the rights and privileges of Europeanness nonetheless. It's certainly not the same as being without papers or possessing a passport that allows for much less free movement across Europe and the world. Radical Basque nationalists and supporters of ETA can certainly be accused of underemphasizing the rewards they receive as citizens of a recognized state and holders of passports that enable significant travel relatively freely across a number of borders, including within Europe. The claim that the Spanish state is still fascist has not changed since Franco is a gross historical simplification, and again underplays the significant advantages of Spanish citizenship within today's Europe. As the Emagune document suggests, feminism teaches us that one can be privileged and oppressed at the same time. This combination of privilege and oppression is the state of a significant majority of European citizens. I want to be careful neither to simplify feminism nor to forget that at crucial moments in its history, some feminists have defended violent forms of nationalism, from the British suffragists who supported the First World War to the United States feminists who supported the early 21st century invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq in the name of saving the women in those countries from the conservative forces of Islam. These forms of feminism, by privileging national identity above others, and assuming a global female identity and denying differences of race, class, religion, and so on, became the alibis of the most violent and racist forms of nationalism. I'm holding out hope instead for those feminist movements and theories that begin from a recognition of the differences among women, and recognize the intersections among different relations of power. I believe these forms of feminism have much to teach us still about the complex relationship between privilege and oppression, which are largely missing from writings on Basque nationalism and post-nationalism. Inspired by the works of Passerini and Braidotti, although with some reservations with what I still perceive as a Eurocentrism in some of their work, I read the Emagune document as, among other things, an attempt to express new female Basque subjectivities in today's Europe. Passerini's groundbreaking feminist oral history work helps me to understand the activisms of Basque nationalist women and Basque feminists in the 1960s and 70s as earlier emerging subjectivities in a period in which women in Spain, for the first time since the 1930s, were able publicly and collectively to express subjectivities that were not weighed down with the definitions of Spanish Catholic womanhood that dominated during the Franco regime. In the references in the Emagune statement to domestic and other forms of violence, to solidarity with migrants, to labor and economic exploitation, I hear affective and political echoes of that earlier time. With the aid of Braidotti, I understand these emerging subjectivities being articulated in the Emagune document as solidly situated in the geopolitical, social, economic, and cultural context of the Basque Country in 2016, while also attuned to traditional movements in politics. From Braidotti, I learn as well both to hear and value the utopian tone of these voices, while also to understand how difficult it is still today for women to express individual and collective subjectivities grounded in difference in the face of hegemonic discourses, Basque and Spanish nationalist, post-nationalist, heteropatriarchal, that even when they dress themselves in the language of liberalism and tolerance, continue to reinforce old binaries, hierarchies, and exclusions. In a recent book on the politics of belonging, Neera Yuval-Davis, one of the foremost theorists of feminism and nationalism over the past 25 years, revisits the national question through the frame of belonging. Are nationalist politics of belonging still the hegemonic model of belonging at the beginning of the 21st century, she asks? And if so, what kind of nationalism is this? And if not, what other political projects of belonging are now competing with nationalism? While not disavowing the continued importance of both nation states and nationalist movements in the early 21st century, Yuval-Davis argues that feelings of national belonging are far from universal and that nations continue to be based on a politics of exclusion as much as inclusion. Feminism, Yuval-Davis notes, has developed in its intersectional mode one of the most vibrant challenges to the exclusionary politics of nationalism and nation states. And I quote, inclusion in the citizenship body and becoming entitled to the different kinds of citizenship rights is what much feminism has been about, especially in the early stages of the feminist movement. Although feminists have tended to have internationalist tendencies since their inception, the history of feminist movement has been often focused on the right not only to belong, but also to participate as equal adults in the political communities, end quote. Returning to her original question, what other political projects of belonging are now competing with nationalism, Yuval-Davis offers the feminist ethics of care as one alternative contemporary political project of belonging. Following as well recent feminist work on the politics of emotions, she supports, quote, the emotions of caring and love which underlie what can be seen as the feminist political project of belonging, the ethics of care, and through this, the extent to which caring and love can counteract other emotions as the normative basis of political action, end quote. Yuval-Davis provides an overview of the notion of care as a political project, beginning with the ethics of care as it developed in feminism over the past few decades. She's careful to point out that some aspects of the feminist ethics of care veer towards essentialism, or at least have a universalizing tendency that contradicts the intersectional frame preferred by Yuval-Davis herself. The ethics of care, as widely understood in feminist theory, was developed in the United States in the 1980s, mostly by white middle-class feminists, and particularly by the psychologist Carol Gilligan, who tended not to interrogate their own racial and class positions in relation to the argument that women had been instructed to have a caring morality. Moreover, though the model of care both predates and goes beyond feminist theory, in the North American and European feminist tradition, it is often associated with maternity and mothering. Yuval-Davis recognizes the limitations of these models, most notably that they tend to define care in an intimate mode, and that historically there is much evidence that caring for children, family, and members of the immediate community does not necessarily extend to more generalized forms of care. To the contrary, mothering and community care are often done in the name of violence to others outside the community. And the role of mothers of ETA members in the history of radical nationalism is an example of this that I've pointed out. I agree with Yuval-Davis and many contemporary feminist theorists that historically much political and social theory, and much history for that matter, has played insufficient attention to emotions and the ways in which emotional attachments and detachments structure collective political movements. The history of nationalism certainly cannot be explained by rationalism alone or by a simplistic binary opposition of the rational and the emotional, and nor can anti-nationalism and post-nationalism be based upon claims to reason alone. Luisa Passerini's groundbreaking work on oral history, to which I've referred, stresses the importance of emotion and relationality and intersubjectivity in the construction of historical subjects and political movements. In a different tradition, Judith Butler's important work on vulnerability emphasizes The body is a common site of human relationality and interdependence. But even when, as in the case of Neuville Davis, feminist care is extracted from its universalizing tendencies and it's from its association with white middle-class forms of mothering, I worry that its long historical association with womanhood generally and motherhood specifically make the ethics of care a risky model for politics, whether nationalist or feminist. Substantial work in institutions, political movements, governments, and theories would need to be done to challenge those historical associations and to avoid the labor of care falling once again on the shoulders of women. Yuval Davis recognizes that historically and today, care work, both paid and unpaid, is performed overwhelmingly by the most dispossessed members of society, not just women as mothers, but working class, often migrant women, who are typically underpaid to care for other children and adults. Care itself is mired in hierarchies, power relations, and exclusions. Yuval Davis likewise recognizes that proposals to grant citizenship rights to migrant carers, for example, will not address the myriad inequalities of the care industry. Moreover, while building on theories of emotions, the ethics of care, I believe, too quickly moves away from other models of recognition and inclusion, most notably the idea and ideal of solidarity, which, unlike the ethics of care, is always grounded in the collective. In fact, Yuval Davis's ultimate definition of the feminist ethics of care sounds much like older notions of solidarity, and indeed she cites the example of the Spanish Civil War, the International Brigades, and Che Guevara as examples of strangers fighting in foreign wars. Feminist ethics of care, she writes, does not ground its ontological basis in membership in specific national, ethnic, or religious communities, but on transcending familial relationships into a universal principle of interpersonal relationships. It may be because of its association with old-fashioned left politics that solidarity is less likely to feature in much recent feminist theory than care. Yet solidarity, which certainly does not preclude the place of emotion in politics, does not depend on proximity to the other. Distance does not preclude relationality, but I think it avoids what I perceive as an idealization, or at least an under-theorizing of love in Yuval Davis's writing on the ethics of care. Che Guevara, after all, wrote about revolutionary love in a way that reassigned women to the home and to the role of mother, excluding them from the revolutionary brotherhood. There's no doubt that historically, radical Basque nationalism and ETA have been based upon a substantial and often devastating deficit of care, most notably for the victims of ETA violence, but also for many members of their own, often narrowly defined community, including women, and those defined as outside the confines of the Basque nation, be they Spanish migrants or from outside Spain. I've suggested too that such definitions of nationhood have undergone change in recent years, that nationalism can and does show capacity for change beyond exclusionist models. At the same time, the anti-nationalism and post-nationalism claims sometimes offered by the Spanish critics of Basque nationalism are based on their own exclusions, including their failure to recognize most other forms of difference, such as gender and sexuality. The forms of feminism I've been following in this lecture, and more broadly, the form of feminism typically defended by Neera Yuval Davis, in contrast, take as their starting point the importance of recognizing differences among women and among all humans. They're in their own ways also concerned about the politics of belonging, within and without, to and beyond the nation state, and nationalism. I caution against the ethic of care as a model for belonging because I fear it keeps women trapped in traditional definitions promoted by conservative nationalism and non-nationalisms, and is insufficiently attentive to differences among women inside and outside individual nations. Judith Butler, for example, in her post-2001 writing on mourning and violence, is very careful not to evoke mothering as a model for recognizing the common corporeal social vulnerability to violence that all human beings share from infanthood to adulthood, albeit in radically different ways with radically divergent relations to risk. Like Bradotti, but in a very different way, working often with conflicting theories of the subject, Butler brings a queer sensibility to her writing on belonging, the state, the nation, and Europe. The current European moment, with a dangerous rise in state-centric nationalisms based on violent exclusions, most notably of migrants, but also the new examples of discourses and practices of belonging among sub-state nationalisms to which I've referred, seems a good time to revisit some academic truisms about nationalisms. This is, I think, part of the spirit of the project initiated by Nise, and which the activists and feminist thinkers I've evoked today have much to contribute to. Thank you. Thank you. Excellent. It's always difficult to ask the first question.
And I'll ask one. I'm about to ask it as Nise coordinator. Have you been able to look at the differences or sameness with the evolution in other more left-wing nationalisms like the Dutch nationalism, the role of women, the gender perception, and so on?
No, the main movement that I've studied in comparatively, not using primary sources, but is with Irish nationalism because it's the most obvious comparison. The perhaps greatest challenge of studying the history of Basque nationalism is radical Basque nationalism is inseparable from the history of political violence. So as soon as one starts to compare a movement that doesn't have that history of armed nationalism, the comparisons become complicated. And I want to say that at the same time as saying that I don't think, saying that you can't study radical Basque nationalism without studying political violence is not the same as saying that the political violence itself can only be understood as an expression of a specific kind of nationalism. It's much more complicated. So the Irish nationalist example, I think in many ways, and of course also not only because of the existence of the IRA, but because of a shared religious history as well, with Catholicism, and in particular kind of way in which historically Catholicism both constructed women, mothers, as particularly strong in society, and that's something I think that Irish and Basque societies share in many ways, but also the public sphere remained very much in the case of men. And the IRA, like ETA, incorporates a lot of left, in fact, defines itself as a left nationalism. So to me, that's the most ready comparison. And in fact, there are an awful lot of similarities. Also, similarities of women's experience in prison, although the prison regime in Northern Ireland was particularly harsh at certain times, but it was in the Spanish state as well. So in that sense, I think it's difficult to compare Basque nationalism to other sub-state nationalisms all over Europe. It's perhaps easier in the earlier period, in the early part of the 19th century, to compare the Basque nationalist, what was called the EAB, the Basque Nationalist Party's Women's Association, with other earlier movements of the early 20th century. But that's a bit before my period. There has been work done, quite a bit of work done on women in that period, but I don't know if the comparative work has been done yet. But I think that would be one kind of important area, because those movements are unlike later Basque nationalism, where there's quite a close relationship, even though it's conflictual, between nationalism as a left movement and feminism. In the earlier period, there's a real separation. Basque nationalist women were asking for very different things than suffragists, for example. Yeah, so those are, no. Are you speaking of the document that I was referring to?
Yeah.
It's not, they're not demands, and that's what's interesting about it. It's more of kind of an intervention that came after the end of 2 years of women from different political groups coming together in the light of the ETA's permanent ceasefire, which this time lasted, was actually permanent. And I think if there's an implicit demand, it's that women be taken seriously as part of the peace process. Because again, and I know there have been studies, I mean, mentioned Cynthia Coburn's work on Northern Ireland, the Balkans, and Cyprus. There's an irony to the histories of national conflicts in which during the conflict itself, women are often frequently seen as being potential brokers of peace, but actually after the conflict, or once the arms are laid down and there's a negotiation for a peace, women are then not actively part of the peace process. So if there's a demand in this document, I think it's that. I think it's that as this, there is no formal peace process in the Basque Country yet, there won't be, I don't think, as long as the Conservative Party in Madrid is in power. But I think that would be that's the implicit demand or the implicit, of the document, that women be actively incorporated or actively part from the beginning of any process in the peace in the Basque Country. But more, I think it's a reflection and an interesting one to my mind on the different ways in which the conflict has affected people. And I think this wasn't the direct topic of my talk tonight, but I think that now that 5 years has passed, the time to reflect upon the enormous kind of political, emotional, personal, collective toll that the conflict has taken is now. And I think in many ways it was more, the impression I have is it's the outcome of a series of discussions around what it has meant for people, many of whom were born in the Basque Country while the conflict was going on. And while it was certainly a low-level conflict, it was there constantly all the time and really did permeate all areas of Basque life. And these are mostly academic women, so absolutely permeated academic life, for example. So I think it's more that, a reflection, and as someone who's been watching the Basque conflict for over 20 years, I was very much interested in that kind of space for reflection in quite an honest and open way. I think there are two things there. I think, first of all, ETA emerged out of a period of dictatorship and also out of a very conservative movement that was conservative because it was nationalist, it was conservative because it was middle class, it was conservative because it was Catholic. It was generally the Basque Nationalist Party, and is still today a conservative movement, although it incorporates now a greater range. We talked earlier about Euskal Kaltasuna and other, corporate. But during its founding period in the early 20th century and into. So that's the legacy that ETA picks up. And it even its engagement with left politics is always somewhat, the priority is always on independence and on thinking of ways. So I think while there were people within ETA in the 60s and 70s, there certainly were, who were had more contacts with a wider variety of movements, the main focus was always on the national conflict. And the other thing that's absolutely crucial is the use of militarism, the use of armed struggle has, and I think this is true in the IRA as well, has a conservative, a kind of impact on a movement for all sorts of reasons. Because militarism itself historically depends upon quite strict divisions of labor in terms of women and men. Those then became interestingly even more enforced because they were working in a wider social context in which it would have expected that men were the ones who would be the freedom fighters and women would hold up the home. So I think a combination of the legacy of conservatism coming from Spain and from Basque nationalism and militarization. And interestingly, these ideas persisted even while more and more women were becoming involved. So there's a kind of disjuncture there between the changing realities and the changing values and discourses, but that's a very common phenomenon in political movements, that they're not reflecting reality, they're shaping it, but they're not reflecting it necessarily.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for...